So hi, welcome. I'm Sean Veit Oakes, and I'm going to talk today about a topic in the Buddhist texts and the teachings of the Buddha that doesn't get emphasized a lot in insight meditation, in Western convert Buddhist systems. And this is a teaching known as the Six Realms. The teaching of the Six Realms, when it does come into contemporary Buddhist teaching, particularly in convert lineages, like insight meditation, is often brought forward as a psychological teaching. And so I'll speak to that a little bit, as well as to some of its historical roots and some of the ways that it's presented in the Pali Canon, the record of the early Theravada Buddhist system. And then I'll offer some ways that we might practice with it currently that hopefully are a kind of middle ground between these two approaches, the ancient and we might say the modern or the postmodern approaches. When the Buddha talked about the process of being alive and how it unfolds, the laws of nature that govern our existence, he talked repeatedly about the law of action and its results, called kamma. The word literally means action. That's the Pali analog to the Sanskrit word karma. And part of the implications of the law of kamma is that actions always have results, and that actions undertaken with intention, and here this is a very technical use of the word intention, it really means like volition. There was some potentially unconscious but intended action happening, and this is a way to say that it excludes mistakes, which is interesting. But volitional action has an ethical charge to it. So it either has the intent to help or to bring about goodness or blessing, well-being, or it has the intent to cause harm, to bring about non-well-being. And as such, actions are motivated by either wholesome qualities like loving kindness or compassion or wisdom, or unwholesome qualities like greed, hatred, or delusion. And how this law of nature, of kamma, unfolds, in a way quite logically, is that if that first premise, that actions always have results, that always bear fruit, would be the traditional way to say it, if that's true, then they must bear fruit not just in our individual lives, but they must bear fruit far into the future, right? Because it's obvious that not everything bears immediate fruit, karmically speaking. And the early texts understand this. You know, people would ask the Buddha, like, what about someone who's, you know, a really terrible person in the present life? They're greedy, they're miserly, they're a murderer, they do some terrible thing. But they don't actually seem to suffer in this life. Maybe they get quite successful, you know, titans of industry, all that. How do they suffer? It doesn't seem like they're suffering as a result of their actions. Or, you know, conversely, someone might seem to be quite good, quite generous, quite kind, do lots of good actions in this life, but they still seem to suffer. They are, you know, they suffer under poverty or ill health or attack or oppression of many kinds, even though they're good people. This kind of questioning, and, you know, it has, in the texts, very often these kind of questions are taken relatively literally, like, why can't I see this person suffering? They're obviously a terrible person. You know, why can't I see this person reaping the benefits of their goodness? They're obviously a good person. This line of questioning tormented the medieval thinkers in many different religions. You know, the Christian philosophy in Europe really struggled with this, you know, phrased in the form of a very common question in many of our cultures, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? And people will still ask this in ordinary culture, like even in secular, kind of psychologically oriented popular culture, you know, folks might express something like, I'm doing good. I'm doing the best I can. I'm a good person. I'm kind. I'm generous. You know, why can't I catch a break, basically? And it's a really good question, right? It's an ancient question. So the Buddha's teaching on karma, on how actions unfold over time, in the mix of the complex system that they happen in, right? Our lives, the world, our communities, is an imperative and central teaching, right? Partly because without this teaching, it's very difficult to speak of the path from suffering to liberation, right? Because our actions, namely the actions of practice, learning to be generous, learning to be kind to ourselves, to others, learning to work with the mind and the afflictive emotions, coming to some clarity. These actions, volitional actions that we call practice, they bear fruit, but they, of course, don't always bear the fruit you want in this particular life, right? You can say, may I get enlightened in this particular lifetime, and, you know, here comes the end of your life, whether it's, you know, this afternoon at the hands of a runaway steam train, or 50 years in the future at the hands of runaway, you know, old age, sickness, and death, you may not have achieved full enlightenment, you know, if that was your goal, or, you know, you may not have achieved any other wonderful, important goal, racial justice or gender parity or any number of good things that will take a very long time and, you know, millions of people's lifetimes of effort to solve. Deep problems take a long time to solve. If they ever get solved in any kind of finality, you know, certainly all of these things can be thought of as ways to say we have to have a framework in which we can think about actions and the effects of those actions stretching out far beyond our individual lifetime. And if we don't have that framework, the risk is a kind of nihilism. Like, you know, whatever my efforts, when I die, it's all just gone, right? And I think one of the main ways that secular culture in the West deals with this is it acknowledges the truth that our actions have results past our lifetime, but mostly puts those results in relation to other people. Our actions affect our families, our culture, our communities. You know, they essentially join the stream of actions we call history, and they contribute to the future. But we largely evade the question of what happens to the distinct stream of actions and intentions and awareness that we call ourself or our conscious being. What happens to consciousness, essentially? And, this is in contemporary neuroscience and some fields, this is called the hard problem, the problem of consciousness, because you can't find it in the material system of the body, you can't identify consciousness in the brain. You can identify the symptoms of what's going on, you know, electrical impulses, chemical impulses change, etc. But where is this conscious thing? And then people have to always ask when they encounter the teachings on rebirth in the Buddhist system, or in the Hindu system as well, which is different, what is it that gets reborn? Many, 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 many cultures beyond Buddhism and Hinduism as the most prominent examples held an understanding that when bodies die, something of the energy of their being goes to another realm, and then in part of a complex process comes back to this realm. And many early cultures, sort of pre-scientific, pre-industrial cultures, held this view, including the classical Greeks. Plato held a form of reincarnation. But many, many earth-based cultures hold very many different models of rebirth or reincarnation, in which the being, the person, the soul, the essence, the momentum of a being goes to another world, a subtle world, and then through some process returns to this one. That process is described differently, right? Sometimes it's described as like one goes to the world of the ancestors, and then the ancestors return to this world in the form of children. So some cultures will say, oh, grandchild, Sylvie is great grandmother Martha reborn, like, oh, there she is. There's a sense that like one's own relatives become reborn as one's children in some models. In some other models, like in the Buddhist system, one gets reborn outside of one's bloodline, but not always. Like, you might think about the Tibetan system, where young children are recognized as incarnations of past masters. And in many cases, that those recognitions happen within the family line. So, a child is recognized as the reincarnation of their, grandparent, for instance. And there are some reincarnation lines within the Tibetan teacher lineages that kind of hopscotch a generation, because you can't be a reincarnation of your parent who's still alive. So it has to be of someone who's a little further back. And so there can be this kind of flip-flopping thing that happens. That system, is actually very coherent with some of these ancient earth-based or animist systems, where rebirth is very much about one's relationship to the ancestors. And the thing that gets reborn is an ancestor. But there's a few distinct aspects to the Buddha's use of this framework. And the most important is that the Buddha, far more than the Hindu system that he influenced and was influenced by, that was developing at the same time out of the Vedic world that preceded him in South Asia, the Buddha very distinctly framed rebirth as an ethical process. So you get reborn wherever you do, not because of your family line, your bloodline, right? That would tend to support caste, which is where the Hindu system went, in part. The Buddha said, no, it's really where you get reborn is one of the effects of your actions, and therefore it's ethical. So if you do good actions, you're generous, you keep the precepts, you clarify your mind stream such that you're not causing harm, you tend to have a better rebirth. And the texts are very literal in some ways about this, in some ways more literal than perhaps is comfortable. A certain kind of person who commits a certain kind of misconduct is reborn, ugly, like physically unattractive, or is reborn, as a certain kind of animal or insect or something. Or a person who does a certain kind of good action, wholesome action, is reborn in a heavenly realm or a fortunate human realm that is, a kind of symbolic parallel to that action. One who is very generous gets reborn wealthy, something like that. These kinds of things are very, very common. So the Buddha frames the process as ethical, and then describes the pathways of rebirth in this particular way. And this is where the teaching on the six realms really comes into being. The term the six realms actually shows up a little bit later in the Mahayana systems. In the Pali Canon itself, the term six realms isn't used very much. And in some descriptions, in many descriptions of the realms, actually, there aren't six. In many descriptions, there are five. So the divine realms, the Deva realms, and the what came to be called the jealous god or titan realms are somewhat collapsed together. In others, the Titan realm is omitted entirely. But largely, this framework of six realms has come down to the modern world, and it's most recognizable in the Tibetan model, where there's this very well-known image of the wheel of life, the Kala Chakra, where which is a huge circular image, you know, painted generally in tanka form. In the middle are animals symbolizing greed, hatred, and delusion in an endless circle spinning around each other. And then around that is the two polarities of the sentient being rising toward wholesomeness or falling toward unwholesomeness in an endless circle. Around that are the six realms themselves, which from highest to lowest are the Deva realms or the God realms, the Asura realms, or the Titan or jealous God realms, then the human realm. In the Tibetan system, those three are considered the fortunate rebirths, and that's different in the Pali system. And then below that are the difficult or unfortunate rebirths, the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm or the pretas, and at the bottom the hell realms. And so in the big mandala, these are arranged in a circle, and in the wheel of life image, that circle of six realms is further surrounded by a circle of 12 stations or nidanas, links, the 12 links of dependent origination, starting essentially at 1 o'clock with ignorance, karmic formations, and moving through the sequence of consciousness, name and form, the sense doors, and the whole process of making sensory contact, pleasant and unpleasant experience, grasping, clinging, becoming, birth and death, and around the whole thing. So this, and then the whole thing is held in the jaws of this enormous demon, the demon of time, death, and time being the same fearsome entity. So this is a very ancient image and an idea about what we're doing here. In the earliest Buddhist sources we have, in the Pali Canon particularly, in some sources, the Buddha describes all six of these realms. In some, fewer realms are described. And in a couple of sources, the Buddha simply says, in a way that feels almost like it's an echo of much more ancient language, he speaks simply of this world and the other world. And that in a way is a parallel to some of these very, very ancient, animist or earth-based understandings, where the understanding is that there's a visible world of beings, humans and animals generally, and then there's another world of beings that we can't see most of the time until the heart mind is quite developed. And again, sometimes those are realms of ancestors, some of those are realms of spirits, etc. In the Buddhist model of the six realms, then, we have an image of a cosmos full of beings, and the beings that we are just one part of that. We're humans at the moment. I'll assume that most folks listening to this are human, but if there are any animals listening in or devas listening in or other folks, blessings to you. May you be well. And the process of karma is that when these bodies die, based on our actions in this life, we, unless we attain full release, arahantship, the final phase of awakening, in which one is not reborn into a future state, we are reborn in one of these six places. So the human realm is broadly the human realm that we know and live in. It has a mix of pleasure and pain available to us, and this is the primary reason why, It is the main realm. It's the only realm, really, in which beings actively can practice the Dharma and can awaken and step off the round of rebirth. There's one little exception to this that I'll speak about in a moment, the realm of the non-returners. But largely, this is the place of practice. And it's said in the texts that we can practice here partly because there is enough leisure time and interest in practice. So interest in practice comes from suffering, right? You would, if you didn't suffer very much, you might not have very much interest in, you know, getting off the wheel. If this was totally a pleasure palace, you might be like, this is cool. You know, I'll do this again. I know some people with that viewpoint. They're like, human life is great, actually. And I'm like, yeah, you're privileged. You know, we'll mention privilege in a second. But largely, human life is helpful because we can be passionate about practice, but we're also not in such crushing, dire suffering that we're unable to practice. And this is an interesting teaching for modern, particularly social action-oriented folks who might want to say, you know, and I would say that we might say this almost in a sort of as an echo of the kind of egalitarian spirituality that many of us inherited from, you know, the good parts of something like Christianity or Judaism, or any of the monotheisms really, that you know, all human beings can practice, all beings are worthy of awakening, which is absolutely true. But it's not absolutely true that everyone can practice in a formal sense. You know, when one is starving, destitute, you know, under attack, it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult to practice the subtler aspects of Dharma practice. But the teachings make clear that everyone can do something, you know. And because ethics is the thing that gets you reborn, it's actually much more important to do basic ethical action than it is to do like deep meditation, for instance. So, you know, someone who's starving and you know, really suffering in a material way and, you know, doesn't have the circumstances of safety in which to meditate or, you know, study or contemplate, you know, deeper aspects, a simple act of generosity on their part can be enough to impel, you know, a much safer and more pleasurable rebirth, perhaps one with the amount of leisure in which one could do more formal practice. So the human realm is characterized by enough leisure time to practice and an interest in practice. And the other visible realm that we have access to is the animal realm, right? Here's animals all around us. Our, you know, our pets, our dogs and cats and fish and birds and et cetera are all here. And then all the wild animals, you know, all the way up to the, you know, the extraordinary animals, and they're all extraordinary. I don't know. The ones that we feel like we can communicate with most, how about that? The ones that are closest to us, we think of them as extraordinary because we're a little narcissistic. We think humans are the best. They're not. That's the whole point of this system. But we do this thing with animals. We're like, oh, you know, the dolphins, the octopuses, the, you know, the brilliant animals. And then, but then all the way down, you know, down whatever that means, hierarchically to, you know, the bacteria, the, you know, the viruses, et cetera, which are also considered sentient beings. You know, they're part of the animal realm here. So the animal realm traditionally is considered a not favorable rebirth. And this rubs some modern earth-based or, you know, earth-based spirituality influenced folks wrongly. But the idea here is that life in the animal realm is both repetitive, like the cycle of you know, feeding and procreating, etc., just goes on and on in a pretty repetitive way. But also that it's hard to be moral or ethical. You know, one of the main things that would get you born out of an animal realm, for instance, would be and there's ancient tales that you know, speak to this, would be an animal, for instance, resisting the urge to kill another animal for food, you know, even if it meant their own life, because they would be keeping the precept of non-harming. And then that would be the cause for them to be reborn in a heavenly realm or a human realm. So the animal birth is considered not the most useful place to practice. One of the common rebuttals against this that I've heard is that, you know, animals being in a kind of immersed in nature kind of state don't need to practice. And broadly, I'm down with that. Like that kind of makes sense to me. There's a way that if you're not suffering, you don't need to practice. But within the Buddhist understanding, we would then have to really discount or deal with the idea that we could be reborn as animals, right? And one of the things this system really points to is that the distinction between the species is not particularly solid. You know, we get reborn as animals, animals get reborn as us, we get reborn as deities or devils or angels or any number of things, ghosts. And these are almost places that one gets reborn more than they are types of individual, right? And you can see how all of this points to the teaching on anatta or selflessness, right? Like, oh, I'm not really this body. I'm actually not even fundamentally human in terms of like something that I could identify with. Identifying with being human would be extra here. We could identify as a sentient being. And then we would retain that identity throughout all of this migration through the realms. Even that is still just an impersonal process. But it's better than identifying as your species. So there's the human realm and the animal realm. The other unfortunate realms are the ghost realm or the peta in Pali or preta in Sanskrit. This is often translated hungry ghosts. And one of the interesting details about the ghost realm is that it's thought of as being the realm of the ancestors, and particularly of the unwell ancestors. Ghosts here are depicted as beings with insatiable hunger and thirst that can't ever be satisfied. And even more painful than those are the hell realms, where beings are tormented, you know, for long periods of time in horrendous physical ways. And just like in the medieval Christian commentaries, the range of physical tortures in the hell realms is described in extraordinary, colorful, terrible detail. You know, different places in many different hells in which one is repeatedly impaled or burned or shredded or any number of ways of being tortured. And we can see in the descriptions of the unfortunate realms, you know, how easy it is to make an emotional parallel. The hell realms are have the feeling tone of hatred, and you know, the ghost realms have the feeling tone of thirst and greed, and the animal realms have the feeling tone of dullness. So greed, hatred, and delusion there. And this is going to fold into the most popular modern version of this, which is the psychological interpretation of this. Going back up to the fortunate realms, this realm that's considered fortunate in some of the later Mahayana systems, like the Tibetan, but is not considered fortunate in the Theravadan, is the Titan or jealous god realms, the Asura realm. This is the sometimes it's called demons, although another word for demon, yaka, is often used. But the realm of the Titans or jealous gods these are incredibly powerful, you know, strong beings. Some are quite smart, some are quite beautiful, but they have the attribute of being grasping at power, grasping at success, And if we go with the psychological, we could think about our kind of, you know, titans of industry, highly privileged folks, manipulating power. And considered wholesome in all the systems are the god realms, the deva realms. Maybe it's not so useful to use the word god, because god in the monotheisms really means something else, like an all-pervading benevolent principle. Here, the deva realms are, you know, maybe they're more like angels, you know, or profound natural forces, which is partly how I'm going to think about them. But the devas live extremely long, comfortable lives, really strongly characterized by pleasure and ease. And it's because these lives are characterized by pleasure and ease that they are not particularly conducive for practice. The gods in the Buddhist texts are often depicted as being reverent toward the Buddha, and some of them do attain stream entry, the first level of liberation. The king of the gods, Sakka, achieves stream entry in one beautiful text in the canon. But they don't get enlightened. There's not actually enough suffering there to impel their practice. Sakka, the king of the gods, gets really inspired about practice, and then when one of the Buddha's disciples decides to pay a visit to him and see how his practice is doing, he's gotten distracted by building an enormous pleasure palace, and he's sitting there with you know, dancing nymphs and celestial musicians, and he's like, oh, I haven't really been practicing so much. So it's really hard for the gods to practice deeply. And all of these realms, you know, god realms included, deva realms included, are impermanent. You get born in them for some time. You have a lifespan there. It could be extraordinarily long, like the length of a cosmic eon, but you still die in the end when the karma that got you there is exhausted, the momentum is exhausted, and you get born somewhere else. So this is the ancient kind of literal idea about this thing. And the most common interpretation of it in contemporary Buddhist teaching is the psychological. And because of that, I won't say a lot about it right now, but I'll bow to it a bit. This is, there are precedents for interpreting these as psychological states, even in the earliest texts. You know, there is a text where the Buddha says, you know, if you hang out with unwholesome friends, that's like, you know, an angel hanging out with, if you're wholesome but you hang out with unwholesome friends, it's like an angel hanging out with demons. If you're unwholesome hanging out with unwholesome friends, it's like a demon hanging out with demons. If you're unwholesome hanging out with virtuous friends, it's like a demon hanging out with angels. Of course, it's best to be an angel hanging out with angels, you know. So there's some hints like that, that you can psychologize these things. And this is tremendously useful. Like, this is partly why it's a useful framework for modern folk, even if you don't want to take on that these realms could be, you know, descriptions of literal, or whatever that means when you're talking about subtle realms, that they could be real. I'll put that in scare quotes here. But you can really feel into how all around us, even in the human realm, you can see beings, you know, consumed by hatred and torment, and in a kind of physical torment, you know, that it just looks like we could say casually, like, that just looks like hell. You know, we do say that, you know, or we could see folks around us, you know, I think in the United States with the, you know, kind of crumbling healthcare and social safety net, we could see folks on the streets in many of our cities who we might, you know, in a not classical, but, you know, evocative way, say like, oh, it feels like there's like these people, these folks are like ghosts. You know, there's so much wounding. The hunger, certainly we've seen images of people suffering from profound malnutrition, where the image actually looks like the ancient ghost realm images, huge, you know, distended stomach, ravenous hunger and thirst, inability to satisfy that and become healthy again. So we can see that, oh, there's a kind of, sometimes you might encounter someone who, in whom greed or lust or wanting or craving has completely taken over their system. Think about like the, like deep addiction, like kind of folks really suffering profoundly from addiction. And you might say, this is like a ghost realm, like a hungry ghost realm. The animal realm, characterized by dullness, sometimes in, you know, we might lightheartedly, but not, you know, characterize aspects of modern life as having a kind of animal-like repetition to them. You know, often this is done as an insult, you know, sheep are lovely. I don't know why they get such a bad rap, but, you know, sheep just going along with the herd, as it were. Likewise, in the for the upper realms, you know, using titans or asuras or jealous gods as a metaphor for those psychological states of people with, you know, some power, some privilege, who are using that power and privilege in an unwholesome way. You know, there's a lot of that in the world. And then folks in the god realms, you know, who might be, you know, sometimes when I was going to raves, I would sometimes, you know, I would be going around seeing all the people, you know, dancing in their sort of, you know, beautiful costumes. And, you know, some of them look like they're really having an incredible time. Some of them look like they're really suffering. And I might be like, oh, over there's the ghost realm, you know, people with their particular drugs in the corner. And like over there, there's the god realm, you know, the beautiful people in ecstatic, you know, moments and whatnot, having, you know, sustained pleasure, but, you know, not for very long. We could see that the fortunate realms, the god realms, exemplify potentially a kind of unprocessed privilege, right? There's a lot of comfort and ease, but not so much groundedness or contact with, you know, actual suffering. And that the hell realms and the ghost realms exemplify, you know, a kind of fields of trauma, you know, where there's been profound harm and wounding and not enough care, support, again, to be grounded or well. So it's very useful to feel these realms as psychological experiences. But to finish here, I want to emphasize a third lens on how we might look at these things. And this lens is partly influenced by some time I've been spending lately with different bodies of teaching, particularly coming out of contemporary animism, including some of the ancestor work of Dr. Daniel Foer and others. But thinking about this, also threads of this coming out of some of the kind of earth-oriented or ecocentric Buddhisms that are arising right now, as well as some postmodern pushback against Buddhist modernism, and particularly against the highly secular kind of, stripped down versions of Buddhism that have become popular. And this is a way of using the teaching on the six realms to suggest that Buddhism actually in a certain substantial way can be thought of as a kind of animist worldview. Here's a couple ways to think about that. At the heart of what we might call animism is the sense that the world is alive, that all of the aspects of the world, plants and, you know, earthen objects, you know, rocks and streams and mountains and stars and space and all, they all express a kind of awakeness, a kind of consciousness. They all have a kind of awareness in them that is distinct to their kind of being. So, you know, we think complicated narratives. It doesn't look like stones think complicated narratives. But we also, it would be a kind of hubris to propose that because it seems like we are conscious, because we communicate in language and tell stories, etc., and we don't see, for instance, stones doing that, that they don't possess any kind of consciousness whatsoever, right? That would be a species-centric view. And animism just proposes that, like, you know, that's very few humans in the history of humanity have held that view. You know, for a very, very long time, by far more humans held the view that everything was alive in various ways. And if we look at the Six Realms teaching, it actually looks like the Buddha and the early culture around Buddhism held some part of that view. You know, there are, you know, spirits that live in trees and mountains and rivers. There are nature spirits all around. The Buddha interacted with them. There's many discourses in which the Buddha interacts with local nature spirits, interacts with ghosts, interacts with beings in the hell realms, goes to visit beings in the heaven realms. One of the heaven realms, called the heaven of the 33, is actually the realm where many of, in the Buddhist system, where many of the ancient Vedic gods live. And the Vedic gods, these are the deities in the South Asian system that preceded historically the well-known devotional deities of later Hinduism. So they precede, Shiva and Kali and Krishna and Sita and Rama and Ganesha and that pantheon, as it were. The early gods are really elemental gods. Indra is the storm god. Varuna and is the god of the waters. And you know, there's deities for wind and for rivers and for mountains. And these gods that are the elemental deities in the Buddhist system live in the heaven of the 33. And many of them have the same names and the same stories associated with them. It's clear that in a cultural sense, they're the same beings. And so we could say, oh, well, they are the same beings. Those beings live extraordinarily long lives. Indra may well still be alive. The king of the gods, Saka, is actually sometimes called Inda, which is the Pali version of Indra. So Saka may well be Indra in some layers of this understanding. And so then we have a world where there's not only humans and animals that are sentient, right, that have a kind of knowing element in their consciousness, but there's also the world all around us. You know, all of these prominent elements of the world have a kind of intelligence to them. You know, and in modern science, you know, particularly thinking about groups of beings like fungi, you know, like mycelium spreading out, you know, under the entire forest, communicating. Like, there's a growing sense that the natural world has a kind of intelligence. All this was really assembled, within some of our lifetimes or the preceding, you know, generation by as the Gaia hypothesis that, you know, the whole Earth has one conscious being, you know, and we're just part of that. That's a very coherent, in a way, Buddhist understanding. So we can think of, okay, ourselves, the animals, subtle beings, natural forces, all as being real. And I think that comes easily to folks. I wonder then if it's only a step. Like, once you accept the reality, as it were, of subtle beings, you know, that a tree or a mountain or a stream could be awake or conscious in a certain way, could have a kind of self, or a sense of self. I think that's the leap for materialist culture. And beyond that, it's a shorter leap to say, well, undoubtedly there are other kinds of beings as well. You know, the universe is vast. Who knows what's out there? What about beings that have extremely long lives by our standards? Right? Our lives are counted in years by, revolutions around our particular sun. There's no logic to suggest that a being could have a different kind of body, revolve around a different kind of sun, and live, you know, a very different kind of lifespan from us. Or even that something like a planet, which of course was a deity in the ancient systems, you know, Jupiter as a deity, a very long life, very, very long life in a subtle, you know, not so material form. So the teaching on the six realms then can be a pathway to opening to the consciousness of the entire cosmos around us, where everything manifests its own kind of knowing. And in our long existence, revolving around this wheel, we participate in all those different kinds of knowing. You know, in the same way that I might say that the breath that I'm exhaling now will be inhaled by a tree and, you know, 10 billion years from now will be in a different part of the solar system maybe, or wherever. That, you know, that first law of thermodynamics that says that, you know, energy is neither created nor destroyed. We simply, the solution to the hard problem of consciousness is to just make that little leap to say that consciousness is a kind of energy, which experientially it clearly is. And to say that, well, that is never created nor destroyed. And so then there's an exchange of sentience. There's an unfolding process of sentience that includes us, but that also includes all these other kinds of beings. And that to wake up to who we are in this process actually means waking up to our place in that enormous web together. You know, I think that the reason why someone asked the Buddha, you know, are you human? And he said, no. And they said, are you a god? He said, no. Is because when you wake up and you step out of the six realms in your consciousness, you realize that actually you can't be defined by any one of those stations, by being a demon or a human or an animal or a ghost or a titan or a god. But that you've understood that all that's happening here is that your present moment consciousness is participating in a vast, interwoven, cyclical unfolding. And to identify with any point in it, you know, would be like picking one random chord in the middle of, you know, a long piece of music and saying this chord defines this piece of music, which of course it can't. Yeah. So then the Six Realms becomes a pathway toward a kind of vast ecocentric or cosmos-centric consciousness, but particularly a pathway out of a kind of species-centric, almost narcissistic, limited view, where we are human, humans are, you know, the pinnacle of something. And I think particularly out of the view that when these bodies die, there is nothing more that we participate in. You know, whether you think about yourself having an essence that gets reborn or simply as part of unfolding ecosystem level process, it feels imperative for liberation for us to remember, to connect with the ongoing nature of every part of ourself, that including our knowing part, the conscious or intelligent. The word Buddha means awake. It also means intelligence in Sanskrit. Buddhi is intelligence. The intelligence aspect of our being actually pervades the universe and cycles through it until it realizes, until it understands the entire thing completely. And only when it understands the entire thing completely can it set down the momentum of successively identifying with these different things. Once you no longer identify with these things, that's synonymous with no longer being reborn into them.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.